was fair. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Dr. James Miskalik left for Abyei, a war-torn Sudanese village, in 2007 as part of a Doctors Without Borders team. He says as he kept in touch with friends and family back in Canada, he realized, in his words, that people are hungry to be brought closer to the world, even its hard parts. And he says that which separates action from inaction is not indifference, it is distance. He hopes that by telling the stories of Sudan, that distance will, again in his words, fall away. James Miskalik is the author of 6 Months in Sudan, a young doctor in a war-torn village. The book grew out of the blog he created to tell his family and friends about the village where he was focused, its people, its poverty, and the war that ravaged it. The region straddles the border between North and South Sudan. As Dr. Miskalik notes, it had been claimed by 2 armies, but owned by neither. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. A founding editor of the medical journal Open Medicine, James Miskalik is currently an assistant professor in the University of Toronto's Faculty of Medicine. 6 Months in Sudan, a Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village is published by Spiegel & Grau. You'll find more about our guest, his blog, and his book online at www.6monthsinsudan.com. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Miskalik, welcome. Thanks so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Sure. After decades of war in Sudan, the peace agreement of 2005 held some hope for peace. But this village, Abyei, and a couple of other areas were left out. And then last year, conflict erupted again. And then, as I understand it, the North and South agreed to refer to the matter to a tribunal in The Hague. Can you give us an update?
Sure. You know, the Hague Court of Arbitration was asked to make a decision whether the borders that were established in the 2005 peace agreement were fair. Now, Abyei is defined in the agreement as these 9 tribal chiefdoms, and whether the claim from the north is that the people who decided on the boundaries in 2005 had overstepped their mandate. So last, I guess it was 2 weeks ago or so, July 25th, the Hague delivered their final decision. And many of us whose interest is focused on that place in particular, because it holds so much of the tension between North and South, that long, long war that, you know, predated Darfur by many, many years, we were waiting with bated breath to see what would happen. And as it was, the Hague decided that there was perhaps some mistakes made in the original decision. They suggested a different boundary, which actually was somewhat in favor of the North in that it gave them some more access to oil fields, but it was received peacefully so far. So, you know, as opposed to what happened last year, I was able to breathe a sigh of relief and feel a lot easier going about my day, knowing that that is holding so far.
Yeah. If this is to hold, if it is to succeed, what will be required from both sides?
I think, you know, anytime you have two opposing parties that disagree, whether it's individuals or whether it's groups of people, you have to retreat to a point of consensus, an agreed-upon point of consensus that is, for instance, you know, can't we all agree that we want an end to the war in our country, that we want to get on to a place where our children are able to grow up in peace and somewhat in stability. So I think that if both sides agree with that and decide how to move forward, I think that that is obviously the only way this is going to last in terms of capacity building for the South, which has very little infrastructure, which is, as you might know, you know, war wastes a country away, like chronic disease wastes away a person. And so there's very little infrastructure, very little access to health care. Few people probably understand the necessity or even perhaps how to vote. And I think in anticipation of a referendum in 2011 that is going to decide if the South becomes an autonomous country, an autonomous region, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to encourage the capacity of them to assume that great responsibility.
What happened in the village last year in May of 2008, and what's going on there today?
Well, in 2008, in May 2008, fighting started. I think it was between militia groups on either side. It's often they have loosely affiliated groups, which sometimes it's more politically convenient to do fighting that way than rather, you know, risk the ire of an international community by declaring, you know, a war or, you know, involving obviously many more people in it. So I think it started in between militia groups. You know, their sides declared their allegiances, and eventually the town was razed to the ground, the civilians fleeing to a town about 30 or 40 kilometers away. And today, I understand, since then, it's been relatively peaceful. In anticipation of this decision by The Hague, I've heard the people who had been returned were facing some food shortages because no one really wanted to deliver foodstuffs, knowing that it could end poorly again, waiting for that other shoe to drop. But MSF is starting to work. I actually received a letter or an email from the doctor who's about to assume responsibilities in the hospital there again. So I think people are starting to come back.
What led you to apply for your first mission, which was Santiago, Chile?
Well, that was as part of a medical student. That was very early on in my career, as before I even understood there was such thing as, you know, Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, or missions. And I went to Santiago between my first and second year of medical school, not having traveled anywhere, not even knowing that you could go on a plane to a different part of the world and inhabit a different culture. No one in my family had been past high school, and my parents gave me the best advice they could, which was go to university if you can. And I did. I went to and ended up going to medical school and had that first traveling experience. I'm sure many people can share how profound that is at an important time in my medical career as I was forming what I wanted to do. And I realized not only, you know, that great perspective that my story was one of 6 billion stories for the first time, and how small it made you feel and how wonderful the world, how much bigger it was than I realized, but also that if I was being trained to take care of the sick ones, if that's what society expected me to do, if that's why I had a certain privilege by being a physician in society, then it seemed that the sickest people were elsewhere, or so to my eye. And since that moment, I decided to work my career towards, you know, a reality what was very much like I experienced in ABA. I chose emergency medicine because I thought of all the specialties. It gave me the best combination of skills to be used when there's no other resources or no one else around, and also didn't, you know, necessitate me leading patients in a lurch because I don't have a patient practice. I just work shifts. So it was all kind of leading up to this kind of MSF experience. Mm.
And are you still part of the organization?
Yes. Yeah. As much as I can be, you know, MSF is known for its vigorous debate and dialogue, internal questions and arguments about it, and it's great to be a part of it as the organization is, you know, changes in response to changing needs in the world. And I look forward to going again in January, I hope, to do another mission. I'm working with a project in Ethiopia that's not to do with MSF, but I anticipate doing another mission early in 2010.
Mm. How do you pull in your experiences, these experiences that you have had, and share them with your students now? You're an assistant professor at the University of Toronto in the Faculty of Medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you know, a wonderfully robust area, as opposed to if you're specialized in the, you know, the cornea, maybe there wouldn't be as much to talk about. But when you claim to do international work, and that ends up being the whole world, there's a lot of things to talk about. Yesterday, I had a chance to talk to students in a small group, and there was two students from Jordan, two from Palestine, two from Israel, and two from Toronto. And it was such a wonderful group. Mm-hmm. And I talked to them just about the role of the humanitarian and as a physician, and I find the two have a great congruence, meaning that, you know, one of the principles of humanitarianism, as I interpret it, is neutrality, in that I, to the greatest need goes my attention and my resources. And as a physician, it's the same. You know, I do the best that I can for the person in front of me, regardless of who they are or where they're from. And I think because of that, that identity, identifying the human in need or the human in suffering, is a natural fit between humanitarianism and being a physician. So it's, I find the students, many, particularly younger ones, are very responsive to that idea.
Mm. What was Abiye like? What were your first impressions of the village when you arrived?
No, I remember the plane ride leaving from El Obeid, which is the largest town south of Khartoum, and then it's a small plane ride in a very shaky World Food Program plane to a cracked, rumbling landing strip. And, you know, the town appears for a second, and then it's gone. And then my first thought, of course, is like, that's it? That's there? For 6 months, I'm here. These half-built huts, you know, with straw roofs and clay walls and no power lines and no irrigation system, no ditches. And, you know, my first thought in addition to that is, you know, how there was no one was growing any food. It seemed like, from what I could tell, there was several, you know, hundred, maybe thousands of people in this area in obviously very close, living very close to the earth with not a lot of room for a buffer zone for either of us. And with that initial arrival, it became a very small world for me, from the hospital to my hut, back and forth for a long time. And mm-hmm. So my one lingering regret is that I never got a chance to really see very often what was surrounding Abiye.
Yeah, that beat you were on from the hospital to the place where you slept, marked by just a couple of landmarks.
Yeah, the buried tire in the corner, and then the military compound that was attached to the hospital, you know, from one of the armies. So, you know, when we first arrived to Abiye, there was a section of the wall, like the military compound was abutting the hospital. A section of the wall had been broken down, the soldiers were moving freely throughout the hospital. And MSF arrived and said, you know, we will assume responsibilities for the hospital and give free health care and free medicines, but on the one condition that we're going to put that barricade up where that hole in the wall is, and you're welcome to come in, but the only rule is there's no guns inside the hospital, and essentially returned that place to the people at Abiye, maybe the only place where people could go and feel that kind of freedom.
Mm. Dr. James Maskelik is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He served with Doctors Without Borders in Sudan, leaving for a war-torn village there, Abiye in 2007. He is the author of 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. The book grew out of a blog he created to tell his family and friends about Sudan. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. As a way of further describing the village, maybe you would read an excerpt from the book. And
sure.
This is a blog entry, and it's called 24.
April 10th. I'm trying to paint a picture of Abiye, but all I have are hurried strokes. Yesterday, after dinner, I was sitting in the open space of my compound, Compound 3. It is adjacent to Compound 1. The measles emergency tent used to be here, and eventually a warehouse will be built. Right now it's empty, except for my bed under the tree. The night was ink. Overhead, a flock of white birds flew, fluttering like pieces of paper. They landed above me and noisily settled in for the night. The shuffling wings mixed with the voices of my neighbors and the tinny music of their radios. The air smelled of dust and burning plastic. I woke at dawn, and the birds were gone. The sky was cloudless as I folded my mosquito net and shook the dust from my sheets. The smell of plastic was still in the air. On my way to the hospital, 480 paces, I passed children on donkeys and men on bicycles. I answered them, "Fine, how are you?" "I'm fine." Plastic bags blew by with gusts of wind and were carried into a nearby open field where they flapped thousands strong. I passed 2 sisters. The youngest, 10, was dressed in a white dress, frills on the shoulders. It was torn, and its white was choked with dust. No princess ever looked more important. I returned from the hospital for lunch and lay down. I was somehow sick again in the middle of a feverish dream, organizing something again. What? Again. When I was called on the handset. A woman had been run over by a car. I opened the door to the emergency room and saw the piece of white bone pushed from her leg, glistening brightly. Later, a large truck pulled into our road and backed up to our gates. They carried from the box a stretcher with a woman and a new baby on it. Twins, we were told. One delivered, the other not. We took her to the delivery room and removed the blanket. Between her legs, a tiny blue arm. I touched it, and the skin came loose. How many days ago was the delivery? 6. 6 days ago, a baby was born, and her brother, almost. He made it to his shoulder, and finding nothing to hold on to, went no farther. I saw a child in our feeding center whose mother carried with her 2 pieces of wood. What for? I asked. Well, my translator explained. When she was born, there were 3. Now she's the only one. So our mother cut 2 pieces of wood and said, these are your brother's. How long will she keep them? I asked. Forever, he said. It is later that same day, near dusk. I am sitting in the compound in the gazebo, typing on the medical computer. Just to my left, Paolo is giving John a haircut. He leaves soon. And Tony has just handed me a mirror to inspect my own sorry state. I need a shave. The radio just crackled beside me. I'm on call. Once I'm done with whatever work, night business, the hospital has in mind, I will walk to the kitchen, eat what I can, leave for my compound, shake my sheets, tuck in my mosquito net, and fall asleep. 24.
That is a blog entry that James Maskalik wrote in Sudan. It is now in his book, 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Measles, accidents, childbirth. What other kinds of needs were there in this village? Are there in Sudan?
I think that, you know, you have a population of people who are living so close to absolute poverty. You know, I think it's not unique to Sudan, particularly so there. But with so little access to choose their own, you know, means of freedom, you know, without enough food, without freedom from disease and malaria, how can you really be free? So, you know, not able because of that position to really understand how to perhaps live their life or make a better one for their children. So not just, you know, disease, but, you know, access to food and clean water, an opportunity to choose their own government, perhaps, something that we all take for granted. You know, it's something that I hope with writing this book, I think, I kind of want everyone to read it, obviously, not because for any particular reason, just I feel that we have one chance to understand our world. You know, I see that lesson repeated to me every day. And it doesn't diminish your experience of the present moment to know the world that you live in. It doesn't diminish your diminish your experience to know where your food comes from or where your effluent flows into the lake. It doesn't diminish your experience of the world. It is experiencing the world to know your place and allow you to choose correctly what you do. I don't think it is necessarily a call to action as it is a call to understanding. Mm. And I think that I knew when I came back, the thing that you live with inside of you is if you could take 10 people off the street from my street in Toronto and take them to Abbaye and show them a feeding center full of kids who don't have enough food, 8 of them would say, we can never let this happen again. What can we do? And so that's, I think, part of that dissonance that I write about when I start the book.
Yeah. You start the book with some words from Joan Didion. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be great if you would read them here at this point.
Sure, they're very important to me when I read them.
Yeah.
I'm not telling you to make the world better, because I don't think that progress is necessarily part of the package. I'm just telling you to live in it, not just to endure it, not just to suffer it, not just to pass through it, but to live in it, to look at it, to try to get the picture, to live recklessly, to take chances, to make your own work and take pride in it, to seize the moment. And if you ask me why you should bother to do that, I could tell you that the grave's a fine and private place, but none I think there do embrace. Nor do they sing there, or write, or argue, or see the title boar on the Amazon, or touch their children, and that's what there is to do, and get it while you can, and good luck at it.
Hmm. That's a wonderful passage.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And that was from a commencement address at the University of California in 1975.
Yeah, I
so
know.
How did you come across this, and how did it affect you the first time you read it?
A friend of mine, I have a fondness for quotes, and a friend of mine sent it to me several years ago, and I was, prepared, told MSF I was going to go away, made my whole life, packed up everything, gave up my apartment, was sleeping on people's couches, waiting for the call to go away, and I was sitting outside the office of a friend of mine, and my phone rang, and it said MSF Toronto, and I picked it up, and it was the human resources officer said, we have a mission in Darfur, it's only men, because of reasons for security, it's a mobile mission, we're moving all the time, and assessing the needs in, a fairly difficult area, and I said, can I call you back? Can I think about it? As my position became a little bit more real, what I was agreeing to do, what now was I willing to lose? And so I left that building without meeting my friend and rode around on my bike in the fall. And I went home and I pulled up that quote and I read it. And then I called MSF back and said, yeah, okay, I'll go. Hmm. And so it was instrumental, I think, in that.
Yeah. Now, that particular mission didn't come off to Darfur,
no.
But soon enough you were in Sudan.
Soon, suddenly, Sudan.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my initial choice for the title of my book, but it was too close to Suddenly Susan. They didn't want to use it. And a young doctor, I think I would, a youngish doctor, I think it's getting less young all the time.
Yeah. So anyway, as you've alluded to now, this would be your first posting in a place ravaged by war. What were your thoughts about that as you were getting ready to leave the place where you're being briefed in Geneva, in Europe, and head on into Sudan?
Well, I think that I developed an interest in, I worked in Cambodia with this rural population of Khmer Rouge who just defected, and I had this really unique contact with some of the people there, a commander in particular, who we talked very frankly about what his life was like since the 70s and what he'd done and where he was now. And I became interested in that concept, in what conflict was, because I couldn't understand it. I didn't understand where that lied inside of me, although it must be there. of all the things I value in the world, and as all the things I lament, I think can come, I can find within myself. But, you know, war, I didn't really know it well enough. And so I had an interest in it. And maybe it was a little self-destructive, but I was, you know, I was curious. And so when I, you know, when I arrived to Abyei, and when I decided to go, of course I was a bit trepidatious. I created the life for myself where I would, you know, I had no family and no responsibilities. So, and such was a perfect candidate to go to a place that was a little bit risky. But MSF, of course, takes their, you know, security very seriously because they know that the proximity of us to fighting because of the nature of conflict having changed over the years is greater. And for a volunteer organization, you need to have a primary responsibility to the people who are working for you. So I never really felt particularly in threat or in danger. In fact, you know, of course, the people who were most at risk were the Sudanese people who I was treating, and the greatest risk was with, you know, malaria or tuberculosis or meningitis. So once you arrive to a place like that where you see so many soldiers and every third person has an AK-47, after a couple of weeks you don't even see it anymore. You notice other things, and you get habituated, and maybe that's not the best because maybe your radar becomes a little bit duller. But after a short time, I didn't really notice. I didn't really think about it as much.
Did you think of home much?
Yeah, I think so. I think more about, you know, where is my home? What is my home? This isn't it. And, you know, was it in Toronto? Where was it? Did I have one? And so I think that many people who do this kind of work, who make it their life, kind of feel a little bit rootless or make their world their home. I'm not sure which it is. But that concept of home is one that kind of repeats itself throughout the book because, you know, we left our homes to go to these people's homes who they were trying to return to it and make a life for themselves. And it's a constant, you know, that and time is a constant theme. You know, I think that I realized when I looked around at Abyei and saw the cracked brown ground, it became, you know, essentially mud in about 15 minutes of rain. And I wonder, who would ever live here? Why wouldn't you go anywhere but here? But I think that, you know, your home calls you in your heart, and you want to be close to that place where you fell in love for the first time or raised your children or you know, got to know your grandparents or your friends. So I think it's something that I thought about a lot, whether it was particularly in Toronto or just in general.
Well, if I'm recalling correctly, there are a number of times, or there's at least one time, you correct me if I'm mistaken, where you've gone away for a little R&R and you come back and someone says, "Welcome home."
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was a nice feeling. It was good. Yeah, it was glad. I guess maybe home is where the people who care about you are.
Yeah.
So it was a good reminder.
Where you hang your hat at the moment.
That's right, yeah.
Well, tell us something about the members of the team you worked with in Abyei.
Well, you know, there was the vast majority of people who I worked with in Abyei were Sudanese. You know, MSF, that's one of our points of pride, or at least mine anyway, is that most people who work for MSF are national staff. So, you know, support staff, many of the nurses were Sudanese, so our translators, obviously. Of the people who were expatriates, there was five of us. There was myself. There was a Swiss administrator at first. A British field coordinator whose job it is to assess security on the ground and have a relationship with military commanders. And a Swiss nurse, a French logistician. And the team changes. And with time, I arrived, my first day was, you know, halfway through many people's missions, so it changes, and with it, the personalities change. So especially with a small team like that, when it's just you in your compound, because once your translator goes home during the day, once they have, you know, they go home to be with their family, you're walking around in a bubble. I don't speak Dinka or Arabic, and so you're left with this, you know, this given family that you have, the five of you, in a compound. You don't leave at night because it's, you know, dangerous. And So you with some of them you make very good friends, with others you make only good colleagues, but there's this great kind of membership of being a part of that thing that is MSF, declaring yourself as interested in peace and in parity, that you kind of, it's a privilege to call these people, to live so close beside them.
Yeah. Tell us about Mohammed.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine. I miss him. He's, as far as I know, he's in Chad. He was a newly graduated Sudanese doctor, and a good one. And I say that not, you know, out of any personal affection, but I always recognize it and I respect it. He had a sharp mind and was a very good person, and in some ways was such a salvation for me when it wasn't easy for me to feel alone, to have someone who I could ask to help me out. He was, I think, well-respected and well-liked by all of the staff and stayed there for months after I left. There was a time where it became, human resources became a bit of a problem. There wasn't many people who were sticking around. People were quitting. People in Khartoum were leaving. We were getting, it was very, very, very narrow, the conduit between you know, Khartoum and us, but he stuck around and he stayed there after I left. And as far as I know, he's still working with MSF. I sent him a copy of my book and I haven't heard from him in a while. It reminds me I should email and I'd love to talk with him and know what he thinks.
Yeah. I like him very much.
Me too.
He comes across in the pages of this book as a fine man.
Yes.
Thinking about home and family and the relationships we build with one another, maybe you would read an excerpt from another entry in your in your blog, and that is a piece called Glass.
Sure. I was, this is, you know, framed in, I think there's times during the mission where you don't, you lose perspective. You're so close to things, you don't really know why you're there. Maybe it's constantly repeated to you, or was to me, maybe it's because things were thin and there's little reminders. There wasn't anyone telling you that you were doing a good job. And you realize, of course, that's not what it's about. It's not about a pat on the back, but sometimes you forget. So we talk a little bit about it between me and at least one of my friends in the mission, Tim. So Tim and I were talking just now, wondering what we are doing here, not simply as two men the same age, with friends left behind and a future on hold, but as humanitarians, as MSF. There's no active conflict, and though perhaps we were too immersed to notice small signs, things seemed peaceful. The returning population is not huddled together under plastic sheets, sharing latrines with 19 others. The hospital needs attention, so much of it, but isn't that true of nearly everywhere? The memory of the precise chemistry behind supersaturated solutions sits fragmented, like much of my pre-medicine studies. I believe the founding principle is one of entropy, that as one adds energy to a system, it increases its randomness. What it allows is for one to add much more of a certain salt, like sodium acetate, to a heated quantity of water than it would bear otherwise. It requires a completely new and clean beaker full of pure distilled water. As one adds heat and chaos, he adds salt. It dissolves and he adds more, and more heat, and then more salt. The salt dissolves into its constituents, and the heat makes sure that the molecules ricochet faster and faster, knocking other ones loose. Soon, all the salt has been added, and it is all in parts that are flinging themselves against the glass borders of the beaker. If one removes the heat and allows the beaker to cool, the disorder lessens. The ions slow down. They spend less energy bouncing off one another, and in fact, would form crystals again if they could, but they can't. There's no solid substrate. You are left with a beaker of clear water sitting on your lab bench, full of molecules waiting to precipitate, but none of them having anything to hang on to. Now take a glass rod and just touch the inside lip of the beaker. A small piece of glass dust flakes off, so small you can't see it, and falls into the water. In an instant, the water becomes a crystal, completely solid. The molecules are at rest. I think for me, that is the reason why we're here, to be that piece of glass. It doesn't matter if you're from the north or the south or a Christian or a Muslim or a civilian or Dinka or Miseria or soldier. We deliberately don't care. Our intention is to make a place that is safe and solid for everyone in Abyei. And it is not just about medicine. That is only our tool. The hospital is not just a place to treat the Dink infant with meningitis or the little Miss Aria girl with malaria, but a place where their fathers can reach for the water barrel at the same time and say to the other, after you. No, after you. And maybe, 2 weeks later, when they pass in the market, they will nod. And perhaps, 2 years from now, they might stop and talk.
Mm. That is Dr. James Maskalik reading from 6 months in Sudan, a young doctor in a war-torn village. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon if you've got a question or a comment. We'd love to hear from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Earlier in the book, you write about a woman who comes to the hospital. She brings nurses tea. She comes to the hospital on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And one day, she comes to the hospital sometime after being raped. She has also undergone, it is clear, what is termed infibulation. That's kind of the, I guess, neutral word for what that is. Would you tell us about that story? And in this kind of a situation, as someone from the West, from North America, how do you try and stay there in that moment with that patient?
It was the first time I can remember being really angry and not understanding. I mean, infibulation is removal of the labia and the clitoris and sewing them together, so you're left with a very small introitus or entry to the vagina. And it's traditional practice in some cultures in East Africa, elsewhere, I don't know, perhaps. I remember it's the first time I, you know, relativism, saying what I just can't understand because I'm not from a culture. I mean, it's something that's been infiltrative and in some ways useful in the past many years, saying that there's something just unavailable to me because I don't understand. But I couldn't get past that intent, that she was, intent was for her to suffer. Deliberately, it seemed to me. And I had no, I mean, my heart obviously went out to her to do everything that I could. I would do everything that I could for her, no matter what it was. And so, but that was that point where I really couldn't make sense of it as a, you know, no matter how I tried to rationalize it or be conscientious. And when I wrote the book, I wanted to leave that scene in very much, because it's not only is it powerful and true, you know, everything in that book, as far as I can recollect it, is true to what happened. But I wanted to obviously tell the story of how women sometimes in places like this have no opportunity to, they're not free in a way to determine their own destiny. But the worst case that I could come up with was I write about it, and then it is, you know, read by someone in Decision Maker in Khartoum, who doesn't let us import the necessary medicine or equipment to perform, you know, medical abortions. So it was something that I sent to Geneva. I was very careful, because even as much as I wanted to tell the truth, because in some ways what MSF does, as it's, you know, its raison d'etre, is to speak out sometimes on behalf of people who don't have a voice of their own. The worst thing I could imagine is that it comes out, it's read, and then 2 weeks later, there's some woman in a similar situation who can't get the medicine and the health care that she needs. So, you know, to MSF's credit, they talked about it, and it was legal in cases of medical necessity, because not only was she raped, she was also sick with an infection because of it. So I kept it in there. And also, as a reminder, I think, to perhaps other younger generations of people, if the med doctors who are interested in doing this kind of work, that it's not about you, I guess. You need to do the best you can for the person in front of you. So it was a difficult 5 pages for me to reread, but an important 5 pages for me to write.
Yeah. Was there concern about your doing a blog while you were there?
Yeah, I think that Well, Canada, I was the first blogger for MSF. And I think that the concern, first official blogger, I think other people had done it in the past. And some people had not paid as proper attention to security. For instance, I think there was someone in Darfur who was affiliated with MSF who wrote a blog that came out against the Khartoum government, which is, you know, MSF, we, as in, because of our interest in being close to patients, we're apolitical. We're independent. Most of our donations are private. 95% of them are private, so there's very little vested interest. And so we try as much as possible to be neutral and independent. And so it required a bit of trust for MSF to let me do it. I'd written a blog before with MSF. I went through South America, through Bolivia to write about Chagas, and Southern Africa to write about HIV, and I wrote a blog to try to tell the story of neglected diseases. And I, you know, wanted to convince them that I would be careful. And so I think that after, you know, I got back, it was fairly new. There's a lot of controversy about blogs in general, from much of which I was shielded by MSF Canada. But now there's many blogs. Now there's many, many people telling the stories of what the medicine is like in Congo or in Haiti. And I think in some ways there's tremendous access that we have to give people insight into part of the world that they wouldn't otherwise have. This publishing platform that is, you know, 2.0 allows these kind of stories to be told, maybe for the first time. And eventually, you know, my hope is that we'll have Zimbabwean people telling their own stories and things like that, and I look forward to reading them once I get a chance.
Yeah. You've written, and I quoted you in my introduction, you say, that which separates action from inaction is not indifference, it is distance. And you hope that by telling stories, these stories, that distance will fall away. How do we, in this part of the world, help make that happen?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm trying to understand the nature of the world that we live in as much as possible. You know, with never been so, maybe it's always been this way, but it's never been, I've never been so easily distracted by what's available with the computer and convenience now than I have before. And so I think that maybe we don't get a chance as often to ask ourselves, you know, big questions about how we can, through our actions or our inactions, make the world that we live in. I think that if, you know, people get a chance to read my book and have an affection of for Abyei or an interest in Sudan, there are places to begin. I think my website is one place to start. As things start to draw closer to the 2011 referendum, I think that's a really great time to encourage our MPs, members of Parliament in Canada, and the similar representatives in, you know, the United States, to advocate for a peaceful transition, for a fair and open election. And I think that's a chance for peace to really foment in a place that hasn't seen it for many, many years. If you know, I guess the question that I ask myself is that, is our nature like our shadow? Do we just, you know, live and love and war? Is that just what it is to be human? Or can we, through intent and through, you know, giving the best of what we know and the resources that we have, prevent some unnecessary suffering from happening? I think the latter is possible. I think that for the first time we're starting to understand the world that we live in. I know it seems like bad news on every corner and on the front page of every newspaper, but my read on it is the world isn't any worse than it was 10 or 15 years ago. We just know about it more. However, we've always, as soon as we, you know, started up that first combustion engine, the CO2 started to rise, and, you know, as soon as the cigarette butts never dissolved, and we that was always the case. And thank God we know now, and we can start to actually work towards a solution.
Mm. There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Dr. Maskelyne, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Dr. James Maskelyne. He is the author of 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. The book is published by Spiegel & Grau. You'll find more about our guest, his blog, and his book online at www.6monthsinsudan.com. I'd recommend you take a look at it and pick up the book as well, 6 Months in Sudan. A portion of the proceeds from sales of the book will go to benefit Doctors Without Borders. It is 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good Wednesday afternoon, everyone. It was a tale of a couple of markets, the wheat and the corn, posting losses, double-digit losses in the wheat market, while soybeans was the strength on the day over at the Chicago Board of Trade, with gains ranging anywhere from about 4.5 to 15.5 to the positive side. Let's look at the particulars in Kansas City. September wheat at a high of 576 and a quarter, a low of 552 and a quarter, settling 560 and a quarter, down 12 and three quarters. December, a high of 593, a low of 569 and a quarter, settling 577, down 12 and a half. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, the high 546 and three quarters, a low of 522 and a quarter, settling 528 and three quarters, down 13 and a half. December, a high of 574 and a quarter, a low of 550, settling 556 and three quarters, down 13 and a half. March of 2010, a high of 594 and three quarters, a low of 569, settling 575 and a quarter, down 13 and a half. July, a high of 619 and a half, a low of 593, settling 599, down 12 and three quarters. September corn, a high of 359, a low of 339 and a quarter, settling 347, down 7.5. December, a high of 370, a low of 349, settling 357, down 8.75. March, a high of 382 and three quarters, a low of 362 and three quarters, settling 370.5, down 8.5. May, a high of 391 and three quarters, a low of 373, settling 380, down 8.5. July, a high of $4 and three quarters, a low of 381, settling 388.5, down 8.25. September corn, a high of 405 and a quarter, a low of 390 and a quarter, settling 396 and a quarter, make that 396 and a half, down 7.5. Of course, that's September of 2010 and December of 2010, a high of 415, a low of 397, settling 404 and a half, down 6.75. September oats, a high of 212 and three quarters, a low of 204 and three quarters, settling 210, down 1. December down 1 on the day as well. The high there, 226 and a half. The low, 218 and a quarter. The settlement, 224. August soybeans, a high of 1182 and three quarters. A low of 1154, settling 1175, up 10. September, a high of $11. A low of 1066 and three quarters. Settling 1088, up 4.5. November, a high of 1048 and a half. A low of 1023 and three quarters. Settling 1045, up 13.5. January, a high of 1050 and a half, a low of 1028 and three quarters, settling 1049, up 13.5. March, a high of 1047 and three quarters, a low of 1026, settling 1045, up 15. Take it out to July of 2010, a high of 1033, a low of 1011, settling 1032, up 15.5. November of 2010, a high of 999, a low of 973 and a quarter, settling 990, up 10. And going to August soybean meal, the high there, 371.50. The low, 359.50, settling 368.60, up 180. September, a high of 343.90, a low of 333.10, settling 341.60, up 230. August soybean oil, a high of 37.56, a low of 37.05, settling 37.52, up 7. September, a high of 37.89, a low of 37.18, settling 37.66, up 6 on the day. In just a moment, we'll have prices from CME Livestock, and don't forget to tune in at 2:06 for Illinois Public Media's Closing Market Report. Our guest analyst today, Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. This is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Now let's take a look at the livestock contracts in Chicago, how they fared there in Chicago during the trading day. August live cattle, the high 84.20, the low 83.10, the settlement 84.07 and a half, down a nickel. October 89.95, the high 88.25, the low 89.72 and a half, the settlement up 7 and a half. December 89.62 and a half, the high 88.20, the low 89.40, the settlement, that up a nickel. February, 89.60, the high 88.45, the low 89.30, the settlement, that up 10. August feeder cattle, 101.50, the high 99.40, the low $100.95, the settlement, that up 37 and a half. September, 101.50, the high 99.47 and a half, the low $100.57 and a half, the settlement, that up 57 and a half. October, 101.55, the high 99.55, the low $100.92 and a half, the settlement, that up 37 and a half. November, 102, the high, the low $100, the settlement 101.45, up 35. August lean hogs, 53.70, the high 51.60, the low, the settlement 53.97 and a half, down 57 and a half. October, 50.75, the high 47.65, the low, the settlement 50.12 and a half, down 2 and a half. December, 49.40, the high 46.60, the low 49.22 and a half, the settlement, that down 52 and a half. February, 54.85, the high 52.75, the low 55.75, the settlement, that down 175. And August bellies, we just have a low and a settlement here on the page, 57.75, the low, the settlement 59.75. And we can take it out to February, the high there on that contract 81.25, the low 79.50, the settlement 80 even, that up 125. The Dow is currently down 22 points at 92.98. The NASDAQ off 17 at 1994. The S&P 500 down 2 at 1,004. Nearby crude in New York trading up 55 at 71.78 a barrel.
Another Chinese import is under scrutiny by the federal government, e-cigarettes.
The smoking everywhere electronic cigarette looks like a traditional cigarette, feels like a cigarette, tastes like a cigarette, but it's not a cigarette.
It's a tube that delivers nicotine vapor instead of tobacco smoke. Retailers say it's a safe alternative to traditional smokes, but the FDA says it's illegal. That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 p.m.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL Urbana. You'll find us on the AM dial at 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Our HD signal at 90.9 FM HD2 and also HD3 is down at the moment for repair, and we hope to get that up and going as soon as possible. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon for the Afternoon Magazine is Jason Croft. The producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In southern Indiana, partly sunny with a few isolated thunderstorms. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny, highs ranging from 77 near Lake Michigan to 90 in southwestern Illinois. Tonight, clear to partly cloudy, lows ranging from 55 in northeastern Indiana to 66 in southwestern Illinois. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, highs ranging from around 80 near Lake Michigan to 88 in the south. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, becoming partly sunny, the high around 80. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, the low 64. Tomorrow,